Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today. Welcome to our continuing legal education program covering the Minnesota Supreme Court March 2011 decisions. We're going to be recapping some recent decisions handed down in the last month by the Minnesota Supreme Court. We're coming to you live today on the conference call from St. Paul, Minnesota. My name is Richard Clem, and I will be presenting today's program. We are live on the conference call. Conference call participants, if you have any questions, we will open it up at the end of the program for any questions you might have. Also, if you have any questions during the course of the program, please email them to clem.law@usa.net. clem.law@usa.net. I will be checking my email during the course of the program, and I will answer your questions. Podcast listeners, this program will be presented as an online, on-demand podcast for attorneys in Wisconsin and other states. During the course of the program, I will be giving two code words, which I need to verify your attendance. Please remember those. They are easy to remember, so if you're driving, you don't have to write them down. You should be able to remember them. And then email those to me at the conclusion of the program for your certificate of attendance. Also, podcast listeners, if you do have any substantive questions about the program, feel free to email them to me to the same address, clem.law@usa.net, and I will answer those promptly, well within the time limit required by your state. Well, once again, we are going to be talking today about some recent decisions by the Minnesota Supreme Court, pretty much everything handed down during March. The only ones that are not included in the written materials are the attorney discipline cases. There was nothing too profound in any of those. I think all of them, or most of them, were simply reinstatements of previously suspended attorneys. But we'll start right out with a constitutional law case, actually covering the Takings Clause in eminent domain, and specifically the Takings Clause of the Minnesota Constitution, which was construed in DeCook versus the Rochester International Airport Joint Zoning Board. And Minnesota law and regulations permit zoning of property near an airport to allow for a safety zone. Basically, it just authorizes local authorities to limit the use of property adjoining airport to uses that do not congregate large numbers of people in the same area, so that if some untoward incident happens, presumably it won't hit too many people. This state regulation authorizing these safety zones has been in effect for quite some time. There was a safety zone around the Rochester Airport in existence. But in 2002, the Zoning Board modified that safety zone by increasing the size of the zone. Some areas came under the heading of safety zone that had not been previously. And even in the areas that had previously been part of the safety zone, the ordinance was changed in such a way so that there would be fewer possible uses for that property. For example, the adjoining property owner, it was a golf course, which was generally allowed, but it limited quite considerably whether any structures could be built on the property. So it did limit the property owner's use of the property. The case did go to a jury, and the jury concluded without too much dispute that the value of the property was diminished in the amount of $170,000. Well, the plaintiff, the owner of this property that had been diminished in value, brought an inverse condemnation action, and alleging that this was a taking under the Minnesota Constitution, and therefore he was entitled to just compensation for that $170,000. Well, the Supreme Court agreed and held that in this situation he was entitled to compensation because the diminution in value was substantial. That cost of providing added safety around the airport was so substantial that that the property owner alone should not be the one to bear it. However, they did state that this is a very, very fact-specific kind of determination. So the mere amount was not the the sole deciding factor, but under the facts of this case, the court held that diminution in value was substantial enough to require compensation, since this was a regulatory taking by the airport zoning board. Well, that was the only case outside of the criminal context this month addressing constitutional issues. But probably the most interesting case handed down in March was contract law, and I wouldn't be too surprised if this case winds up in the contract case books in our law schools, since it is kind of an interesting fact pattern. And the main thing to remember about this case is that when you are drafting contracts and drafting agreements, you better be careful, because somebody made a little mistake here and had to pay for it. But the case does discuss mutual mistake of material fact and some related contract law doctrines. And that case is SCI Minnesota Funeral Services versus Washburn McGreevy Funeral Corporation, which was handed down on March 30th. And that brings us to our first of two code words for our podcast listeners. Our first code word is funeral, which is a word that appears in the name of both parties in this case. Our first code word today for the podcast is funeral, F-U-N-E-R-A-L. Well, as I said, this was kind of a case of sloppy drafting and just kind of general corporate confusion, because this was a contract for the sale of three cemeteries, and for various reasons, it was structured rather than simply selling the three parcels of property and executing a deed. It was structured so that there was a holding corporation that consisted mostly of these three cemeteries, and even though the intention was merely to transfer title to the three cemeteries, it was structured in such a way so that it was a sale of this of 100% of the stock of the corporation that held these three cemeteries. So rather than conveying three deeds for these three properties, it was a contract for the sale of shares of stock. And the shares of stock were basically just holding property, and it was holding these three cemeteries. But there was a slight little problem, and the consideration that changed hands was $1 million. So it was the parties kind of agreed that the three cemeteries were worth $1 million. They were packaged into this holding company and sold. So this corporation, everybody thought, just included these three cemeteries worth $1 million. And it also included a little bit of personal property, you know, some desks and chairs and miscellaneous items with the corporation that the buyer didn't really have any interest in acquiring. So a few of these items, these minor items of personal property, were specifically excluded. There was a provision in the contract saying that they were not coming along in the transfer, and that prior to the transfer, the corporation could dispose of those elsewhere. So anyway, the contract went well, and the seller thought that he was getting rid of the corporate seller thought that they were getting rid of these three cemeteries and nothing else, and that's what the buyer thought. There's really no dispute as to the facts that was the intention of the party, to transfer these three cemeteries. But unbeknownst to the people preparing the contract, this corporation, in addition to owning those three cemeteries, owned two vacant lots. I believe one of them was in Minnesota and one of them was in Colorado. They were the owner of those other pieces of property. Neither the people negotiating the contract on behalf of the seller nor on behalf of the buyer were aware of them, but they were owned by this company. So the 100% of the stock of the company, of the corporation, was being transferred, and unbeknownst to everybody involved in the transaction, it also included these two lots. And the two lots were worth $2 million. So it's kind of a windfall for the buyer here. The buyer thought it was getting $1 million worth of cemeteries, but instead the buyer wound up with $3 million in assets. And again, there was really no dispute as to the values or anything, and no dispute as to the underlying facts. But essentially, these other two lots were included in the transaction by mistake. In fact, the buyer didn't find out until sometime later when he got a phone call from a prospective purchaser of one of the lots. And in fact, the buyer was not even aware of one of the lots until the litigation was commenced. So again, first of all, the moral here for the for somebody drafting a sales agreement is make sure you're selling what you think you're selling. Well, really no dispute that this was quite the windfall for the buyer, because again, they're getting $3 million worth of assets for a price of $1 million. Well, the seller who became the plaintiff went to court and wanted this contract rescinded based upon mutual mistake of material fact. Again, that's one of those concepts you probably remember from law school, something about a cow, as I recall, was the leading case on that. But here, the plaintiff went to court, undoubtedly citing that case, and saying that there was a mutual mistake here. And as to the facts of it, everybody was pretty much agreed what the mistake was. They thought they were getting a corporation that owned three cemeteries, but instead they were getting a corporation that owned three cemeteries plus $2 million worth of other property. However, the Supreme Court did not agree with that. This was structured as the sale of a corporation, and everybody intended that the corporation, with all of its assets, other than ones that were specifically excluded, were to be transferred. And the court held that a mistake merely as to value, and quoting this Costello case from 1918 that they upheld, a mistake relating merely to the attributes or quality of the thing being sold does not warrant rescission for mutual mistake of material fact. And here what it boils down to is it was merely a mistake as to value. The seller intended to sell all of the assets of the corporation. The buyer intended to buy all of the assets of the corporation. And that's exactly what happened. They got all the assets of the corporation. Even though there was There was indeed a mutual mistake as to the value of those assets, but a mere mistake as to value does not warrant rescission. Now, a different result in this case probably would follow in Iowa, because the plaintiff cited the Clayburgh case, a 1969 Iowa case, so obviously about 50 years more modern than the Minnesota precedent. And the plaintiff invited the court to overrule Costello based upon the reasoning of Clayburgh. However, the court did not accept that invitation. It declined to overrule the Costello case, and it declined to follow the Iowa rule as set forth in Clayburgh. They were not entitled to rescission, and there were a couple of similar doctrines. They were not entitled to rescission based upon mutual mistake. These other doctrines are similar. First of all, they said there should be rescission due to lack of mutual assent. But once again, and that's a pretty closely related doctrine, the court held that there was indeed mutual assent in this case. The parties agreed to transfer the corporate stock. That is what was transferred. And a sale of corporate stock means the sale of all the assets and liabilities of the corporation. At the very least, the plaintiff argued, well, if we can't rescind the entire contract, at least we should reform it to conform to what the party's true intentions were. But once again, there was no mutual mistake. The party's true intentions were to transfer 100% of the stock, and that's exactly what happened. Therefore, there was no ground for reforming the contract. One fact that the court relied on, they mentioned, and I think this was kind of a clincher, I think, for me, was that obviously somebody was aware that this property was owned. The seller of the corporate assets had been paying the property tax on these pieces of property over the years. So somebody within the corporate umbrella of the plaintiff, of the seller, was aware that this lot existed, and once or twice a year they mailed out a check to the county to pay the property taxes. So the seller was really not in a position to say that they were that the seller, the corporate seller, was unaware of the existence of these pieces of property, because that knowledge was imputed into the corporation. That kind of clinches the fact that there was no mutual mistake, because the corporation was aware of it, because a corporate entity can't have knowledge other than through individuals within that organization. Since that knowledge is imputed to the corporation, it doesn't matter that the people actually sitting down negotiating the contract were not aware of the existence of this property. So it's pretty clear in this case there was a pretty big windfall. I bet somebody in the plaintiff's organization was not very happy when this discovery was made, and certainly some blame was assessed within that organization. So when you are selling multi-million-dollar pieces of property, you ought to be careful and make sure that the deed says what you really intend, because you will be bound by that, especially if other people in your organization are aware of it. So anyway, I think that was kind of one of the most interesting cases this month, and that will undoubtedly make it into the law school case books. Because that 1918 case on mutual mistake remains the law, despite the fact that some states, such as Iowa, have modified that somewhat. But that is not the case in Minnesota. Well, we move on to some criminal law cases. The first one, State v. Obetta, decided on March 24th, talks about expert testimony in a criminal sexual conduct case, where the issue is whether or not the victim consented. The Supreme Court held that in a case where consent of the victim is an issue, the defendant is arguing that this was not a non-consensual rape, that this was a consensual thing. In that case, the district court has jurisdiction or has discretion to admit expert testimony as to the typical behavior of rape victims on subjects such as whether or not they reported on time, whether or not they promptly call police, whether or not a rape victim in a non-consensual case will have physical injuries, and even if the victim, without giving consent, engages in conduct that is somewhat submissive. So in other words, if the defendant argues that this contact was consensual, and he provides testimony that, for example, it shows it's consensual because she did not even report it to police until after a long delay, or it must have been consensual because the alleged victim does not have any physical injuries, or it was consensual because in evidence of the consent was the fact that the victim behaved submissively. So if that kind of information is put in by the defendant, then the court has jurisdiction to allow expert testimony by the state saying that in a typical rape case, even though it was not consensual, in many cases the victim will delay reporting to police. In many cases, even in a case of consent, there will typically be a lack of physical injuries. And typically, even if there is consent, there might still be submissive conduct. So that the Supreme Court is saying that the court has discretion to allow expert testimony, subject to all of the other rules for expert testimony, laying a proper foundation for it. That is admissible at the discretion of the district court. And in so doing, the State v. Saldana case from 1982 was somewhat weakened because the court in this case had interpreted that case that there is simply a blanket prohibition on testimony like that, that expert testimony is never allowed. However, the Supreme Court, without overruling or really even modifying Saldana, takes a look at that case and says, well, no, that case does not serve as a blanket prohibition. The evidence might be admissible, if the proper conditions are met. Under the facts of Saldana, it was not admissible, but under the facts of this case, it would possibly be admissible. Well, again, what had happened here was that the district court had excluded the testimony based upon a mistaken reading of Saldana. The district court had concluded that it had no discretion whatsoever, that kind of expert testimony is excluded 100% of the time, no matter what. And the Supreme Court says, no, that is not correct. The Saldana case does not necessarily prohibit it every time, provided that it, as usual, is helpful to the jury, and the foundation is laid for expert testimony under cases like Frye, that there's a proper foundation for expert testimony. So the Supreme Court said that yes, the district court does have discretion to accept such testimony, and it it remanded the case to the trial court to determine whether such testimony is appropriate in this case, because the district court had simply concluded incorrectly, it turns out, that Saldana did not even give the district court any discretion to consider it. But the Supreme Court said that yes, in the proper in the proper situation, if the proper foundation for this testimony is laid, then such testimony is admissible, because the mental and physical reactions of a of the victim might be outside the common understanding of an average juror, kind of the basic foundational argument for any kind of expert testimony, that this opinion testimony is allowed when it's on a subject that's outside the understanding of a typical juror. And the court said that in this case, or in some cases, that might be applicable. Therefore, the case needs to be remanded to the district court to determine whether or not it is proper in this case. But it is simply, there is, if anybody thought there was a blanket prohibition on such testimony, there is not. So that to the extent that Saldana said there was a blanket prohibition, that case is no longer the law in Minnesota. However, it was not overruled. It was just the court speaks in terms of a kind of being a misreading, partially a misreading based upon changed more learning in the social sciences. So perhaps the foundation might be easier to meet today. So that's our case on expert testimony. Quite a few other criminal cases. We'll just briefly recap them. Two of them on search and seizure issues. The State versus Deedy, I think it's pronounced, also handed down at the end of the month, was a case of possession of methamphetamine, which was discovered in a cigarette package, which was found during a stop. The defendant was a passenger in a vehicle. The passenger did not consent to the search of her cigarette package, the state concluded. It was a stop for some drug offense for the driver, but the court said, well, there was no grounds for searching a passenger, even if assuming that there was some probable cause to search the driver. The driver was not part of this case. The police officers noted that the vehicle had mismatched license plates, and that's certainly a valid reason to pull a vehicle over to see why the license plates on the vehicle were mismatched, even though it sounds like there was a lawful explanation for it in this case, but it's still a grounds to pull over a vehicle. However, while you might look in the glove compartment to look at the title or something to investigate that, searching for tiny objects inside of a cigarette package probably isn't going to give you too much evidence on the subject of mismatched license plates. So in this case, that did not provide grounds for search of that. Therefore, under the facts of this case, that evidence should have been excluded. State v. Williams, another case on search and seizure. A police officer got a radio call saying that there was an armed assault, and he got there and he saw somebody running, and he saw a pistol in that person's pocket, and it turned out that the guy that was stopped was not prosecuted for the armed assault. The opinion is a little bit unclear on whether he was just totally the wrong person and was just a bad coincidence that day. But he was not prosecuted for that. However, he was charged with another offense, namely carrying that weapon. And the court held that, yes, in that situation, there clearly was probable cause because the guy was running from in the area of an armed assault, and he was armed and he was running. So that probably establishes probable cause pretty well. Interestingly, this raises kind of an interesting Second Amendment claim. We're seeing more litigation about the Second Amendment these days. Because here, part of the probable cause was based upon the fact that this person was out for a run carrying a weapon. He was the question then is, well, is it an element of probable cause when you see somebody with a weapon, whether or not that person has a permit to be carrying a weapon? Here, the police officer stopping this guy for carrying a weapon, if the guy has the permit to carry that weapon, then he's not committing an offense. And here, the officer has absolutely no knowledge one way or another of whether the person he stops to investigate that weapon based upon probable cause for carrying a weapon, does he have probable cause to stop somebody for that offense? Well, that's an issue that that is probably looming out there because somebody stopped, just strictly for carrying a concealed weapon that's not concealed well enough, presumably. Is it an element of that offense that, and therefore an element of the probable cause that the person does not have a permit? Does the officer have to be aware of that? Well, that issue is still out there because the court held that it really wasn't raised properly in the district court. So that issue is out there. The court seems to hint that maybe the officer has probable cause even without that knowledge, but the issue was not squarely before the court, so it really wasn't decided. But that is an interesting Second Amendment case that will probably make its way before the courts before long. So that kind of wraps up our search and seizure. A couple of other criminal law cases. First of all, Rickert, discussing post-conviction relief and the timeliness of it. And the court, the main holding was that the court could consider this post-conviction relief even though it appeared untimely because there had been a previously filed motion for an extension. But the court held that relief would not be granted because there was an ambiguity in the factual basis for the guilty plea as to when the offense had taken place. And the court held that just an ambiguity in the factual basis on these facts did not entitle the defendant to post-conviction relief. The State v. Gajovnik, talks about restitution, kind of a common sense case, I think, but it talks about restitution, and the statute governing restitution in a criminal case is MnStat 611A.04. The court examined the language of that because the defendant was raising the argument that there was not a request from the victim for restitution in this case. The court just ordered restitution based upon its own motion. There was no request by the victim for restitution. The court looked at that and concluded that even though that the statute in a number of places had references to the request by a victim, and even there was a certain time limit for the victim to make that request, but the court held that the district court could still order restitution based upon even without a request by the victim. Here, the sub issue was whether again the defendant had raised the issue in a timely fashion, and that's one area where the request by the victim was kind of relevant, because if the victim had requested it, then the defendant has a certain amount of time to make an objection, essentially as to the amount of the restitution. Whereas here, the issue in the case was whether the court had the authority in the first place to order restitution. So the court, first of all, held that the challenge was proper, that the defendant was not bound by the time limits of the statute because there was no request. But the court still has the authority to award restitution, even in the absence of a request by the victim. State versus Robidoux talks about the sentencing guidelines, and one enhancing factor in the sentencing guidelines was that the offense was committed in the presence of a child. And here the district court had enhanced the sentence because under that factor, because the crime was committed in the presence of a child. However, the Supreme Court held that that enhancement was not proper on the facts of this case because the child was present in the house where the crime took place, but the record was clear that there was no evidence that the child had actually witnessed any part of the offense. The child did not see the crime, hear the crime, or otherwise witness any portion of the crime. Here, the court examined that otherwise witness and held that those words mean to actually sense it in some way. In addition to seeing or hearing the crime, the child could be present if he smelled the crime or felt the crime or somehow witnessed it with one of his five senses. But the mere fact that that the child happened to be in the house, or well, not just happened to be, but the mere fact that he was somewhere in the house, that was insufficient to give rise to that enhancement for a crime committed in the presence of a child under the sentencing guidelines. Well, that wraps up the criminal cases for this month. Moving back into the civil arena, we have a case of talking about tax-exempt property. And in Minnesota, it was a property transferred from a for-profit entity that was subject to property tax. The piece of property was transferred to a church, so during the course of a tax year, it went from being on the tax rolls to something that would be taken off the tax rolls. And local units of government have to set their budgets sometimes, so we have to draw a line somewhere. And Minnesota Statute 272.02 states that in a given tax year, the property becomes tax exempt if it is acquired by the tax exempt entity prior to July 1st. So the the triggering mechanism in the statute is that the property has to be acquired, and the date in question is July 1st. So if a church or other tax exempt entity acquires a piece of property on June 30th, then the property is exempt from tax for that year. If the tax exempt entity acquires it on July 2nd, then the property is taxable for that year. Well, in this case, not a particularly strong case, I don't think, but a church in this case had acquired some property, and what had happened was that legal title did not change hands until September. So the closing, when the seller sat down and signed the deed, did not take place until September. But the church had taken possession of the property prior to July 1st. They had paid the earnest money prior to July 1st, and they had set up shop there prior to July 1st, and they argued that that was sufficient to have acquired property prior to July 1st. And their argument was that even though the legal title had not passed by July 1st, the deeds weren't signed over until September. They argued, though, that because they had possession and because there was a contract for the purchase of the property signed over, that equitable title had already passed. However, the court looked at that and decided that under the facts of this case that the title had not been acquired by July 1st. And mostly what they pointed to was that in the purchase agreement, there were a number of unfulfilled conditions. On July 2nd, some of these conditions had not yet been met. So the purchaser, the church, would have been well within its rights on July 2nd to say, we want out of this contract because these conditions have not been fulfilled. For example, there was a provision in there that the sale agreement was conditional upon the church getting proper zoning to do what it wanted to do on this property. And that had not taken place prior to July 1st. And as of July 1st, nobody could really say for sure whether or not that would ever happen. So therefore, equitable title had not passed by July 1st. So the court said that even if equitable title, it would not have taken place here. The court did go on to say that even without those conditions, that mere equitable title was not enough to constitute having acquired the property for equitable title to constitute acquiring under that statute. It would also have to be coupled with some indicia of ownership. So, for example, a contract for deed that didn't have any of these other conditions to it probably would have been enough to have the acquiring take place along with that equitable title. Our second code word comes from the title of this case, and our second code word for today's podcast listeners is Dakota, the name of the party, County of Dakota, D-A-K-O-T-A, is our second code word. Finally, in civil cases, there was one workers' compensation opinion, but there's not a whole lot to talk about there because that was just an affirmance without opinion. Stately versus Red Lake Builders was the only workers' compensation case this month. There were a a number of orders on rule matters and similar. One of which we'll talk about in a little bit more detail that probably of interest. Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. But on the rule changes, there are a couple of orders relating to audio and video coverage in the appellate courts, and as a separate docket regarding audio and video coverage in the district courts, talking about e-filing and rules of practice for former judges of the court practicing before the court. So, if those rules affect your practice, we have the links to all of them at the conclusion of the materials. There's a link that will take you to those along with all the rest of the cases. Well, the one that probably of interest to most of our listeners today is the on March 9th, the court issued an order extending the increase in lawyer registration fees. If you're like me, you probably noticed that you had to write a little bit bigger check than normal the last time you had to renew your attorney's fees, that is indeed the case. It is a $100 increase that was put in effect a little over a year ago, and the purpose of that $100 increase was $25 to the Legal Services Advisory Committee to help provide legal services in civil matters to low-income persons, and $75 to fund the Board of Public Defense for public defenders in criminal cases. The court, in its original opinion, determined that public defenders in the state were woefully underfunded, to make up that difference, it assessed the $75 fee for every attorney in the state to help finance that. It came up for renewal. Both the Legal Services Advisory Committee and the Board of Public Defense asked that those be extended because they've grown accustomed to it, and they need the money, and the money doesn't seem to become forthcoming from the legislature. The court doesn't talk too much about that the civil side of it, but they are extremely critical of the both the legislature and the governor for forcing them into a position where they have to do that. They make very clear that that's a constitutional obligation of the state, and constitutional obligations of the state have to be funded by tax dollars, only the legislature can assess taxes. So they were very stern about that, but they were also aware that the public defenders very, very much need funding. So the court reluctantly continued that, but they said that we caution the legislature and the governor that they are responsible for putting together the budgets, and we will not continue beyond this second temporary fee increase. And one of the concurring judges called that a line in the sand. They've been extended through July 2013. Everybody has to pay this extra $75 two more times, I guess. But they say we will not do it again. So the the legislature and the governor have to do something to fulfill their constitutional responsibilities to provide adequate funding for public defenders. They have to know that it will not be extended past 2013. Justice Page dissented, and I think every member of the court probably agreed with him. He said that this is a tax. When you when the government takes money from one person and uses it for some governmental purposes, we have a word for that, and that is called a tax. And under the Constitution, we have separation of powers in this state. The Supreme Court does not have any jurisdiction or any power to assess taxes. So Justice Page would have stood on that principle and said that no, we're not going to finance the public defender system anymore. And then he quotes a couple of cases saying that that's a mark of what kind of society we are, of whether or not we do things like provide for a fair defense for people accused of crimes, and that constitutional obligation has to be met by the people with the legitimate power to levy taxes. And the Supreme Court is not one to levy taxes. Again, he dissented, and I think the rest of the court probably agreed with him. Except they also looked at it and said, the public defender's system has to be funded. The legislature has not stepped up to the plate to do that. Therefore, we're going to have to pass the hat amongst the members of the bar, have each of them chip in $75 to cover that. And we will pass the hat, but we will also make it mandatory. So for at least the next 2 years, this temporary increase in your attorney registration fee will still be there, at least for attorneys in Minnesota, of whom we don't have any on the conference call today. But Minnesota attorneys have to pay that additional amount. Well, again, since we are only speaking to Wisconsin attorneys today, and through the magic of the 50-minute hour, we're over those 50 minutes. So I will pause briefly here for questions. So if there are any questions from our live participants, feel free to let me know. Well, I'm not hearing any. If once again, if our podcast listeners have any questions, please feel free to email them to me at clem.law@usa.net, and I will certainly respond well within the time limit set forth by Wisconsin or any other state to answer your substantive questions. But hearing no other questions, I will thank you all for joining me today, and I look forward to speaking to you on future conference calls. For a full schedule, please visit my website, www.richardclem.com, and that will show live programs, conference calls, and Wisconsin podcasts that are upcoming. Thank you once again for joining me.